Accession number 20671, Reel 5.
But the following day, we drove through the carnage that had resulted from the RAF.
So the carnage, had the carnage happened when you captured the 2,000?
No, I don't think so.
No. So that had happened?
Yeah, I think it was happening that day, I think, as we were there, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So did you hear any of that?
Oh, yes, we heard the RAF and the American Air Force coming over. And
and you knew what
and we knew what, yes. Oh, yes, we knew what was, the yeah. intention was, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you went through the gap after that?
That's right, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And unless you've seen and heard and smelt what it's like with hundreds, if not thousands, of men and horses that have been burnt and blown to pieces, it's terrible.
Did you doubt at all the... what had been done, whether it was, you know,
no.
whether we should have done it.
No. As far as we were concerned, the more Germans we killed, the better. The quicker to be over.
Leo Rumley, end of Reel 4. Leo Rumley, Reel 5. So you went through the Falaise Gap, you went through as you moved
yes.
to somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
There are a couple of other incidents which are not necessarily time related, but were in France. And the first one was the one and only time we ever saw our RSM Pendle. We'd acquired some parachute material from the American Airborne, and because of the heat, we were all using them as the neckerchiefs. And we were in a farmyard in France, and suddenly Paddy turned up in his jeep with a driver, and when he saw these neckerchiefs, he went absolutely spare, because he was such a stickler on dress and etiquette and everything, and he was running around screaming and shouting everybody about the disorderly way we were dressed and behaving and everything. And in the middle of all this tirade, he got one or two of the sergeants around him. And suddenly, in the middle of all this, a couple of mortars landed in the farmyard. And we've never seen anybody for so small run so fast and get in that jeep and disappear. We never saw him at the front again. So that incident passed off. And yeah. the
what
other
did you all think of him?
Rubbish. We'd no respect for him at all.
Mm.
He was illiterate. And all he could do was shout off. And so he thought it was more important to have shiny shoes than to be able to kill a German. And that sort of thing, so... the lads had no respect for him whatsoever. But I suppose he was a necessary evil to try to maintain discipline and everything else.
How had he got to be RSM?
I think we... we understood that he'd been... during the British Army's turn of duty in Ireland, either the north or the south of Ireland, he'd been dropped in their lap as a baby. And the army had literally brought him up. And, of course, his education was scant, and he knew military life, and he knew military regulations and how to shine your boots and salute properly. But I think this was probably his first and only time in actual wartime conditions. But I think it was mainly the fact that the vast majority of the troops were more literate than he was. And so that counted for a great deal. I'll give you an instance. He could come on parade in the morning, and one of his duties was to come on the 9 o'clock parade and read standing orders for the day. And if he got a word of more than two syllables, he was absolutely stumped. He couldn't read it. And he used to go around muttering about all these fancy-fangled words. And ordinary words of just two syllables that got him beat. I mean, the majority of us, we'd only had basic education from 5 to 14. But even so, we were far better versed than he was. And outside military knowledge, he knew virtually nothing. Even the sergeant would say that they'd know, you couldn't have a conversation with him. We understood he used to read comics, boys' comics, and that sort of thing. So, but as I say, a necessary evil. The other incident was we arrived at a bivouac. When we broke out from around Caen, it was a bit of a mad dash through France. And you'd probably go all day driving, trying to catch up with the enemy. And of course, of an evening, you had to bivouac up and stop, because it was dangerous to go on in the dark. And so around dusk, you'd be looking for a billet for the night. And this particular night, we stopped in this place. And as usual, you have to dig in. And you stand to every evening and every morning, usually in your slit trench. Well, we dug these slit trenches, and mine was just one side of a low wall. And we dug these slit trenches, and I think we remarked how easy going it was to dig in. Anyway, we dug a slit trench, threw the blanket down. They say it was quite warm, so we didn't bother. And when we got up in the morning at first light, we couldn't believe it. The trench was absolutely alive with maggots everywhere. In our hair, in the blankets, in our clothes, the whole thing. And the reason was that the other side of the wall was a cemetery. And the whole ground was absolutely alive with maggots.
Was it a First World War cemetery?
Oh, no, it was a local cemetery, and there'd been a few people buried only a few weeks beforehand, you know. And the whole ground was writhing with maggots. Of course, in the dark, we couldn't see them. But first light, oh, and everybody woke up.
Yeah.
It was terrible, yeah. And I remember another occasion when I had a dice with death. We'd pulled into this... it was like a courtyard, and the wall on the left-hand side went in a circle away from me. And I was walking into this courtyard along this wall, and the ground was strewn with telegraph wires and the cables of various kinds. And behind me came a Churchill tank from the Royal Tank Regiment. And unbeknownst to me, the tank was whipping up all these telephone cables in the tracks. And as I was walking along, these cables were springing up and tightening, you know, being caught up in... And eventually, I'm trapped against this wall, with a whole wall in front of me of twanging wires. And I thought, well, when they break, they're going to flash in all directions, you know, and I'll get chopped to pieces. And I was backed up against this wall, scared to death. But then they all broke and they all just fell on the floor. I can imagine, because you could hear them tightening up and twanging. They're all copper wires. It was a terrifying experience.
Can you... Can you remember roughly the route you took up through Normandy?
Well, I have seen it, but of course, the names don't mean anything because we should just flash through places, you know, and you'd often see a name place on a sort of board as you entered the village, and it had one on the other side as you left it, but none of them registered because there were so many, and it was just day after day after day. Yeah. And at some time in France, we'd pulled into an area, and somebody shouted, "There's a fire!" And I went to have a look, and we used to carry our ammunition in a Bren gun carrier. Now, I don't know if you know a Bren gun carrier, but the driver's compartment is in the front, and behind him there is a bulkhead, a metal bulkhead, and behind that is the engine. And the ammunition was stacked each side of the engine. But the driver and the commander have a little compartment at the front, and the front goes vertical to start with and then slopes away. Mm-hmm. And so when you're driving, your feet are in the portion that is sloping away from you, and but you can only get in vertically down past the steering wheel and put your feet underneath. And when we got there, it was the ammunition truck that was on fire, and it was already well alight. And I had a very good friend in the regiment called Joe Porter. He was a dispatch rider. And he was a bit of a lad. He'd been a bit of a criminal before he got called up. But he was a good friend. And he was stood on the top of this Bren gun carrier trying to pull the driver out by his shoulder straps. And of course he couldn't because his feet were underneath. And so I climbed up on the front of it, and as Joe pulled him up, I pulled his feet, and eventually we pulled him clear. And we just got him cleared and away from it, and the whole thing went up in a terrific explosion.
Was the driver all right?
He got concussion, and I think he'd been hit in the back by something, because his head was just above the back of the bulkhead. And I think he'd been hit in the head with something from the burning ammunition. But I think he recovered all right, yeah.
Did you know who he was?
I don't know. I don't think he was in the reconnaissance corps, but he was in the division anyway. And Joe didn't see any danger. He was stood up with all the exploding ammunition behind him.
Yeah. His name was Joe?
Joe Porter. He survived the war, and he was killed when we were in Lubeck in a shooting incident.
An accident? Or
an accident, yeah.
So you went through Caen?
Yes, yeah. And up through France. And eventually we arrived at Lille, mm-hmm. on the Belgian border. And there's a few stories about Lille. We were amongst the very first troops, British troops, and as we approached the town, we were stopped by the civilians, and this gentleman came forward and he said that he was some kind of official in the town, and he said in very good English, "Would we mind stopping and having a cup of tea and whatever we did, because the Germans were about to leave." And he didn't want the civilian population to be inconvenienced and possibly hurt or killed if the Germans were going to go. So he said, "If you'd just like to wait, the Germans will leave and you can come in without any difficulty." So we thought, well, why not? I mean, there's no problem. So we had a brew up and so on. Eventually he came back again and said, yes, the Germans have gone, so we can go. And as soon as we got in, he said, "Will you send a patrol up to the woods above the town?" So we said, well, why? He said, "Well, in the First World War, the Germans occupied Lille, and they left, and they went to the woods. And in the morning, they shelled us from the woods. I want you to go up there and make sure that they've not done the same thing again this time. So we did. An amusing incident in Lille. They agreed to, in return for a few hard biscuits and various other bits of food that we could manage, they would open the baths and get the boilers going, and we could all have a shower. So we said, oh, great. So, of course, we were all lined up and eventually allocated. And the showers were either side of a catwalk in cubicles. And because there were so many of us, the army said that we can put two to a cubicle. I didn't mind. It didn't matter in those days. I mean, nobody thought twice about it. It would be politically incorrect today to do what you're saying. But the amusing part was that... all the females of Lille were brought in to walk along the catwalks to look at all the British soldiers having a shower.
Really?
Yes.
Did they say anything to you?
No, they all just walked along, all the women, old and young,
really?
Just looking at the British Tommies having a shower. And there was no curtains or anything, you couldn't draw any curtains. So, but the... the nasty thing about Lille was that we dragged our six-pounder up the steps of the cathedral, because it faced the... there were steps leading up to the front of the cathedral, and this faced the main road across Lille, facing west. And... we all thought that if the Germans were going to come back, they'd have to come back this way again. So we had a six-pounder, which gave us a full view of all the approaching roads into the town centre. So we set our six-pounder, but I wasn't very happy with it, because it was on a flagged platform, and we had to put the ends of the trace up against the wall. Well, I don't know if you know, but when you fire a six-pounder, there's quite a bit of recoil on it. And unless the trace can go back a certain amount, it rears up. The wheels lift off the floor. And I thought, well, it could be quite dangerous, you know, if it lifts up and jumps and turns or something. So anyway, but Sidon said, oh, it's all right, it'll be okay. So we just had a snack and settled down for the first shift. And this priest came to us from the cathedral. And he said, do you think that you could spare two men to assist us? So I said, why, what is it you want to do? He said, well, before the Germans left, they took their vengeance out on our novice priests. So I said, what? He said, well, they always suspected that we were either shielding or were actually running the underground from the cathedral. He said, and... they killed six of my novice priests. He said, and they're in the church. We'd like to get them out. And so we went there. As I told you earlier, burial detail was sort of par for the course. But we found six of these priests, and they're only young lads, and they all had their throats cut, and they were lying in the crypt of the cathedral. It was terrible. So we had to take them out and bury them. He just couldn't bring himself to do it, you know. And the villagers said that they couldn't do it. So.
Lille had suffered a lot.
Yes, yeah. But another amusing incident, the mayor came and made himself known to us. And the big red and white and blue sash. And... his wife said, came with him, and she said, I speak good English. So I said, oh, yes. She said, I have a personal teacher. So it turns out that when the British were retreating back to Dunkirk, this British soldier, who was a Scotsman from Glasgow, got left behind. And the mayor and mayoress had hidden him and passed him off as their chauffeur. And he came, they said he came from Albania or Lithuania or some obscure East, and couldn't speak French and couldn't speak German. So nobody ever asked him any questions. And in his spare time, he taught the lady mayoress English. But he was a Glaswegian. And it was littered with profanities. And she would repeat it word for word as he told her. And it sounded extremely strange coming from a lady. But she thought she was so good.
So what had happened to him?
Eventually, the underground had got him out. And he'd got back to England again. But she was really proud of this fact that she could speak such good English.
Better in Glasgow, probably, didn't
they? Yes.
So, I mean, Lille, had Lille suffered much in the way of bomb damage?
No, it hadn't.
The
no.
occupation?
No, it had been occupied because it's a border town. And it's on the main road up through France, up to the Low Countries. So it had a strategic importance.
Had they suffered, I mean, apart from the cathedral, you know, they suffered much sort of hardship at the hands of the Germans?
Well, I think there was a very active underground movement in that area. And I think the church got blamed for most of it. And the killing of those six young priests, I think, was just the end of the revenge that they'd been carrying on. But they were so pleased to see us. I mean, the parties went on all night long, and it was terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah, they really were. That's the first place that we knew the name of and we could identify with that had came out and celebrated. And opening the baths was the biggest sacrifice they could make, was to spend some of their very scarce fuel to heat the water for a shower for us. We thought, and I thought that was very good. Yeah.
So, how long did you stay at Lille?
Oh, only a couple of days, I think. And then we made one mad dash from Lille to Brussels, mm-hmm. straight across Belgium to Brussels, which had fallen the day before to the Guards Armoured. And
so you followed them in, did you?
Yes. And then we pushed on even further.
So what was Brussels like when you got there?
Well, I remember Brussels more from the second time I visited than I did from the first, because the first time we visited it, there was so much confusion and so many people. I mean, the crowds in Lille were what we thought was quite substantial, but when we got to Brussels, I mean, it took you half an hour to go 100 yards. The people were so... crowds were so vast that the vehicles couldn't move. I mean, had the Germans come back, I mean, we nothing we could have, we couldn't have done anything because the people, so many people about. But
were they jubilant?
Absolutely. Oh yes, absolutely. Yes, yeah. Yes. Yes.
They saw you as conquering heroes.
Oh yes, liberators. Yes, they're liberators. Yes.
So how long did you stay in Brussels?
Only for another couple of days, I think. And then we went to Antwerp, and an unusual situation in Antwerp. I don't know if you know the geography there, but the town sits a bit like Goul in Yorkshire, quite a way down river, Antwerp is. Most ports are right on the coast, but Antwerp is quite a distance down river. And consequently, if you're coming in from the sea, the right-hand bank belongs to Belgium. The left-hand bank is in Holland. And Antwerp is down the river on the right-hand side. Well, we approached it from the other end, of course, coming up from the south. And we got to the centre of Antwerp, and that was clear. We went down to the docks, and they were clear. But all the ships that had been in the port had been sunk. The Germans had sunk them all. And I can't think what the technical term is when they under the water, the seacocks.
I can't think, but yeah, they deliberately sunk them anyway. Yeah,
they sunk
water. Yeah.
And when we went along the docks, we came under fire from the opposite side of the river, and that's the Scheldt estuary, and that was in that's in Holland. That was still in German hands. And of course, although we had the Antwerp and the dock area, we couldn't use the port because the Germans still controlled the estuary. They had big guns on the Scheldt estuary, which covered the whole width of the river, so nothing could move in or out of Antwerp past the German guns. And we've since been back to Antwerp, and we were feted like royalty. And we were shown all the old places, including the old Victorian theatre, which was badly damaged in the shelling. Of course, by this time, we were coming under V1 attack from Holland. You know, the V1s that were the doodlebugs that were being used against England. They were using them against the British troops coming up from the south.
Yeah.
And, of course, Antwerp was just within range, and they got a full load of it.
What were your duties while you were in Antwerp?
Well, our duties originally was to secure the docks, because we wanted a port. We were still bringing supplies up from Normandy, all the way from the beaches in Normandy. It was the only place we could bring supplies in. Calais was destroyed, so we were still using the beaches, and we wanted a port, and Antwerp would have been the ideal port, but as I say, we couldn't use it. And by now, the British Army was sending troops on leave to Brussels and Antwerp for short rests and so on. And we were just outside Antwerp, re-equipping. And there were some leave passers going into Antwerp. And I had one. And my friend at the time said, I don't feel so good, I'm not going to bother going. So I said, well, if you're not going, I'm not going. So I gave my pass to somebody else. And in Antwerp, I forget the name of this building, but there was a semi-skyscraper building in Antwerp. And it was built just before the war. And it housed a restaurant, a swimming pool, a cinema, and a sports complex, shops and everything, all on different levels. And it was a showpiece. And of course, all the lads wanted to go and see a film. And so this cinema was full of British troops watching this film. And the V1 went straight into the building from the top, took about the first six floors out, including the cinema. And I think about a dozen of our lads never came back from that visit to Antwerp. It's a terrible disaster. I could have been one of them, but I didn't go.
Just luck, isn't it?
Yeah. I forgot to tell you, when we were in France, and I can't remember exactly where it was, but we lost our padre. And we lost him because we came across some German dead. And two of them were lying in the entrance to a field which we wanted to use as a bivouac for the night. And our padre said that he would go and bury these two Germans so we could use the field. They were obstructing the entrance to this field. And also in this place, amongst all the ruin and desolation, there was a lovely cottage. Little beautiful cottage with lovely gardens and rose bushes and everything. Our padre went to move these two Germans, and they were booby-trapped, and he lost his life. He was killed. So it gives some idea of the mentality of the Germans. They will booby-trap their own dead to try to kill somebody else on a mission of mercy.